It's Wednesday, January 31st, 2018, and this is KBIA's Views of the News, where each week we consider the most important and interesting stories by and about the news media. I'm Mike McKean, hosting this week for Amy Simons. We come to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Joining me, our Missouri School of Journalism faculty colleagues Ernest Perry and Ryan Thomas. One way to measure influence these days is by the number of followers you have on Twitter, but some of those followers may be fake, including, it seems, some who retweet our governor. Remember how we just talked about Facebook decreasing the number of news stories in your feed? Well, now they say they're going to increase the number of local news stories. How does that work? A couple of local news organizations are getting credit for exposing the sexual abuse by U.S. gymnastics doctor Larry Nassar. And the Pope shares his critique of fake news. We'll get to those stories in a bit, but first let's look at news coverage of President Trump's first State of the Union address last night. The president called for unity. He touted his accomplishments on the economy, tax cuts, and dealing with North Korea. He recognized a gallery full of heroes to illustrate his points. And he promoted his four-point plan for immigration reform. In doing so, he reverted back to language from early in the 2016 campaign, basically equating illegal immigration with drugs, terrorism, and murder.
My duty and the sacred duty of every elected official in this chamber is to defend Americans, to protect their safety, their families, their communities, and their right to the American dream, because Americans are dreamers too.
Democrats, for the most part, were not applauding Trump. They mostly sat with stern expressions on their face. When the president proposed reducing the number of relatives an immigrant with a green card can bring to the U.S., what he calls chain migration, you could hear Democrats booing, hissing, and grumbling. Of course, we're here to discuss the media's coverage of the speech, and that was about as predictable as the reactions of Democrats and Republicans. CNN conducted an instant poll of those who watched the State of the Union. 48% felt very positive about it. Another 22% felt somewhat positive. That adds up to 70%. Not bad for a president whose approval rating hovers around 37%. But the headline for the CNN story? Trump gets least positive reaction in at least 20 years. And here was the take at Fox News. Democrats on Tuesday night took their resistance to President Trump to new lengths, with many refusing to even applaud or stand during his State of the Union address to acknowledge economic gains or an honoring of veterans. So let's get both of your takes on, initially at least, the media coverage of what was a first-of-a-kind speech.
I think it was predictable. I think the media pretty much covered his first speech the way they've covered pretty much everything about Trump since his inauguration, which is you have some who say that he did a great job. You'll have some who say that he didn't do a great job. You have some who are in the middle saying, well, he was positive when it comes to the economy, but then he reverted back to his nationalistic themes when he talked about immigration. So you're all over the board. And then you have some who are saying, well, we'll see how this plays out in the next 24 hours, because after he has this tendency to do something that tries to unite, and then he goes straight to Twitter and it all blows up again.
Yeah, Ryan, I mean, even before the speech, there was a lot of media coverage saying, well, he'll probably rein it in and give a more traditional kind of speech, but is it really going to matter? Because in the morning, Twitter Trump is going to show up. Although I didn't see that Twitter Trump showed up yet, at least not so far.
Right. Well, it is. I think this goes to the nature of the venue itself. It's an artificial environment that really there's not a whole lot of substance there. You see the sort of true character of Trump in the tweets and in how he governs. I think that events like this, whoever the president is, brings out what I would say is the sort of the worst in journalism, whether it's the sort of endless punditry and the speculation, the quick reaction takes, who's applauding, who's not, and then you have the response, is Kennedy going to be running in 2020? All that sort of fluff that I don't think really helps.
As you said, in some ways it's kind of a set piece. I mean, going back to Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton, it follows the same kind of formula. It's really, really long.
Yeah.
This one was like the second longest speech. Also, also it counts on having a bunch of folks that the president invites up in the gallery to be sort of his illustrations of the points he's trying to make. And I wonder what you took on the wide variety of heroes that he had in the stands this time.
Well, I mean, you know, I didn't see the entire speech. I only saw snippets of it. And most of those snippets sort of talked about who he had in the gallery and sort of played off of all of the issues that he wanted to bring up. And he pretty much followed the same pattern that other presidents has followed. You're going to have someone there who is going to speak to, at least in this case, immigration, who speaks to the economy, that speaks to unity and security in the country and those types of things. So I don't think that was outside of what other presidents have done.
Yeah, there was a lot of talk on Twitter about it being exploitative, like using dead families for political purposes. And I suppose there is something about it that's unsettling, but I don't think it's out of the norm of what we've seen before.
One thing that I noticed in terms of a difference between last year and this year, don't go off script if you are a media pundit, it has a particular audience. So Van Jones, remember last year, the liberal CNN host, he was praising Trump after his speech to a joint session of Congress. Well, he wasn't doing that this time. Last night he said Trump was, quote, selling sweet-tasting candy with poison in it. So can even media commentators go off the ranch once they have a certain, I guess, brand that they're trying to promote?
I mean, I think everything's up in the air now. I mean, you just don't know what's going to happen because right now it's we've sort of talked about it here is that, okay, he gave the speech. It followed a certain pattern. Now everybody's sitting waiting for Twitter Trump to show up to see what's going to happen because the pattern that has existed is that he goes a little bit presidential and then he goes in the other direction. So I think right now everyone's sort of trying to decipher or even trying to sort of give a future of what's going to come.
I was almost relieved, and I stressed almost, that the speech ran long because I watched it on NBC. I didn't watch it on cable. And so that limited the amount of punditry that could be done on it. If I was watching it on CNN, I would have probably been tearing my hair out.
Well, you know, another part of the ceremony, and you alluded to this, Ryan, is that the Democrats get to have their follow-on, and they rolled out this time a Kennedy, Congressman Joe Kennedy III from Massachusetts, and he gave their official response. He didn't name Trump, did call him a bully, though. He spoke in Spanish to the Dreamers. But one of the things that social media and even some journalists, and not just the ones at Fox News, were questioning was whether or not he was drooling or maybe he'd put on too much lip balm or something. Is that really what we've come down to?
Well, as I said earlier, I don't think it brings out the best in journalism. I think this is an illustration of that. My personal theory is that it was lip balm, but I don't know.
Yeah, I have. I saw it too, and I went, well, what's going on there? But to me, it's we aren't really talking about the substance. Yeah, and mm-hmm. I think that's become the norm. Mm-hmm. In the last year to year and a half, even going back to the 2016 election, is that we've sort of gravitated to all of the showbiz, the reality television aspects of our politics, and we're not really talking about the substance.
Well, we have talked about something very substantial this past year or so, and that's fake news or so-called fake news. But a different kind of expert weighed in on the subject last week, the Pope. His remarks came on the Catholic Feast Day for journalists. I have to confess, I didn't know there was such a thing. But anyway, Ryan, I want to ask you, Pope Francis said the roots and consequences of fake news actually go quite a bit farther back in history than the election of Donald Trump or his pokes at the failing news media. What did you make of his analysis?
Well, he said it goes back to the Garden of Eden, which I think is, talk about historical context. there we go. I mean, he's laying out two different things which shouldn't be conflated, which are the problem of fake news and the responsibilities of journalists. And really, it's a sort of paean or a sort of love letter to journalists in the sense that, you know, it's journalists' job to combat this fake news. And that's one of the things that I appreciated out of it.
Yeah, I mean, I do in some ways sort of look at it from a historian's perspective, go like, wow, he went all the way back to the beginning, back to, if Eve hadn't taken a bite of the apple and she'd have listened to, and that sort of thing. Well, he was failing, at least the serpent was giving her fake information, yeah, which she should not have followed. But to me, I think it sort of, this whole idea of fake news reaches in all the way up into the Vatican. And I think he, it's a question of whether he was responding to fake news internationally, whether he was talking about fake news in terms of what's going on in Italy right now, mm-hmm. and the fact that they're about, I think it's next month, yep. they're having their national elections, and there's been evidence that the Russians have begun an interference campaign in that. And so he felt the need to speak to this sort of, people need to really pay attention to what's going on and understand what's truth and what's not.
I even think when he went all the way back to the Garden of Eden, that analogy had some relevance to the present. I mean, basically he was saying Eve shouldn't be arguing with the devil. That's what got them in trouble. And maybe the rest of us shouldn't be arguing with trolls on the internet or social media. Maybe we'd be a lot better off if we didn't play into those fears and prejudices and stereotypes that show up in those kinds of venues.
No, I think you're right there. I think that, you know, what he's getting to is, look, we need to have more trust. In those who are giving us information, and until we hear or see or gather some information that shows that, wait a minute, they're not trustworthy, and then we need to call them out on it.
In one way, Ryan, I mean, you said it was kind of the Pope's love letter to journalists. He was saying that we have a big responsibility to protect the truth, but I wonder if it's kind of naive for the Pope to talk about a journalism of peace and the public engage in this sincere dialogue about public events. Is that possible even if we do the best journalism we can these days?
I agree with you. And whilst, you know, who could disagree with truthful, less sensational, honest journalism? The idea that it's solely journalist problem to solve, I think, is a bit naive. There are wider political forces at work here that I think also need to be considered.
You know, one of the things that I did read about this, though, is that, you know, he made the statement, but then you had those who were coming out on the other side. I mean, the Pope got trolled himself saying, you know, well, how could you say that right. when you're dealing with all of these crises of, right. of faith and crises of people doing very bad things within the Catholic Church. I mean, and so it's kind of hard when all of a sudden you have the Pope trying to say, look, we need to really pay attention to this, and then you have these controversies and problems going on within the church. Mm-hmm.
Well, so the Pope was talking about fake news this past week. I want to take a few minutes to talk about fake followers. One way that famous people, or people who hope to be famous, measure their popularity and their social currency is by the number of people who follow them on Twitter. Well, the New York Times published a fascinating investigation on Saturday. It was headlined The Follower Factory. They were able to identify millions of fake followers who were bought or created by this storefront operation in Florida called Davumi. Davumi sold these bots, as they're called, to actors, celebrity chefs, media personalities, and other folks who want people to think that more folks are hanging on their every tweet than actually are. And I'd just like to get your initial reaction to the story. I mean, it seemed to me that the Times not only did a deep investigation, but they found a great way of telling that story online.
One of the things that, you know, sort of struck my eye was not only was it deeply reported, but the use of graphics as well I thought was really good. So I'd encourage folks to look at our links blog to check it out. In terms of the story itself, you know, the ethical issue at hand is misrepresentation. It's misrepresentation of influence or of status or of presence. And you have the celebrities that are named there, noted Kathy Ireland, one of the Real Housewives, Ray Lewis. Not A-list sort of celebrities, but using Twitter in an artificial sense to sort of amplify their presence.
Yeah, one of the things that I found fascinating, not only was the New York Times story, but then there was a story on Forbes which talked about how many companies are sort of moving away from using the number of followers on Twitter as a way to determine whether or not their product or their brand is really gaining traction, because they've recognized that you have these fake followers out there and your numbers can be exaggerated. So they're sort of moving away from that. And I'm wondering whether or not, you know, this is one of the reasons why you don't see these A-list celebrities doing this, and it's more like the B and C-list right. celebrity and famous people are still engaged in this.
Well, and they weren't, you know, just a few fake followers, hundreds of millions of fake followers. And I thought it was really interesting how the Times did the story. In fact, they detail it on a link on our links blog to what exactly went on behind the scenes and how they were able to do it. But what they found was that this company was taking real Twitter users, and they do a few little tweaks, like they'd color correct their photograph and try to get rid of any telltale digital signs. If somebody's Twitter handle started with an I, they would start it with a lowercase l so that everything else looked exactly the same. And if you didn't know any better, you'd think that this was a real person following. But then if you tracked them, these same people showed up following pornographers as well as celebrities, following people in Arabic and other languages that they didn't even speak. And then you have to wonder, well, what is it exactly that leads to this kind of marketplace in the first place? You alluded to it a little bit, but I'd be curious to know why you think all these different kind of people, maybe not all A-listers, but there were a couple of journalists in there, absolutely, are willing to go to the process of buying followers today.
Well, one of the most prominent names that I saw is Richard Roper, who's a prominent film critic. I mean, I think it's the sort of the culture that we live in, the sort of the culture of you know, being a peer influencer, right, and being a thought leader, and being popular, and all those things. Social media, they've always been present with celebrities and so on, but social media has really amplified those problems. I will say really briefly, one of my favorite things that was mentioned there was Jacobin, the radical socialist magazine, now trying to develop its own brand, which is what I imagine Karl Marx would have wanted.
There were some other folks who were interesting to me too. I mean, Lori Grenier from Shark Tank, yeah, is buying them. Hillary Rosen, who, right, is a media personality and a Democratic political strategist, and even a correspondent from 60 Minutes, yeah, was buying this influence.
Well, the other fascinating one was the editor from one of the Chinese media, yeah, operations, yeah, where you can't even use Twitter in China, but he's buying names so that he can get his yeah, his reputation up. Yeah.
You really ought to read, if you can, on our links blog, this piece from the Times reporter describing the process they went through, because it took an awful lot of legwork to just figure out how could you measure whether a Twitter follower was fake or not, and then how could you track them across all these different users and identify the patterns that would let you know it was happening.
You know, one other thing that this story, this is where I think they're probably headed, is that, you know, identity theft. Mm-hmm. This is one of the things that is huge, and the fact that they lead the story off with a 17-year-old who's now 19, and how that transpired. One of the things that's coming out in terms of identity theft now is that children's identities are being stolen and used, and their credit and everything else is ruined before they even establish credit. And I think this kind of thing is sort of follows along on that same pattern.
I thought it was interesting too, Ryan, that this is sort of the unintended consequences, or maybe look at the different things that can roll out of an initial investigative, you know, story. Here they had the New York Times folks that were basically looking at how social media was being used to subvert the election, and they had to apply all kinds of different techniques to get there. And in so doing, they found a professor at Columbia University, I believe it was, who said, well, you ought to look at this as well. So here's an entire investigation that came out of something that they weren't thinking of looking at all.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if we began the show by talking about the kind of journalism that frustrates us, this is the kind of journalism that makes you glad that we're in this field, right?
And to let you know what kind of impact they're having, at least initially, you talked about companies deciding maybe they don't want to use this kind of influence measurement as much. The New York Attorney General is investigating. He says, you know, it's illegal to impersonate someone in New York State, so looking into this company to see if there's anything they can do about it. And a local aspect of this story I found kind of interesting. The Missouri Times, an online news source that covers state politics in Missouri, they didn't use the New York Times techniques, but there's a firm apparently out there. They're called Twitter Audit, and they have this story now on the Missouri Times, and it says that clearly a third of Governor Eric Greitens' followers are fake followers, as if he didn't have enough issues to deal with.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, so Americans watched with horror, fascination, and probably a bit of satisfaction as the trial of former USA gymnastics doctor Larry Nassar has played out in a Michigan courtroom. More than 150 current and former athletes testified that Nassar sexually assaulted them while claiming he was helping them with medical problems over the years. The judge in the case sentenced Nassar to up to 175 years in prison, saying, quote, I have signed your death warrant. But before she did, the chief prosecutor, Angela Povilaitis, praised reporters and one of the victims.
But thank God we have these journalists and that they expose this truth and that they continue to cover this story. Thank God Rachel Denhaller made that first contact with the reporter and decided to allow them to publish her name. How many times have we heard that without those stories and Rachel, victims would not have reported, they would not be here to speak this week, to expose what truly happened all these years behind those doors and under that towel.
So, terrible consequences, obviously, for these athletes, but it's hard to see this as anything but a victory for journalists in actually telling a story that needed to be told with a lot of effort that it took to tell that story.
Yeah, I think that this is, it goes back to something that Ryan has said, is that, you know, this is when journalism matters. And if you go to our Links blog, there's a story there from Columbia Journalism Review that talks about the work that the Orange County Register had been doing on this same issue going all the way back to 2004, but it got lost in the Jerry Sandusky Penn State issue and NFL concussions and a lot of other things. The report on this had been tracing these kinds of issues that going into women's gymnastics all the way back to then, but it took so much time for this to get out, and it took these women standing up by name and exposing what was going on.
So the Indianapolis Star also got a lot of credit for the current round of stories that actually led to the trial of Nassar. So, Ryan, how did that play out? I mean, how does a newspaper in this day and age with the lack of resources, the reduction in resources, come about a story and get so many people to come forward?
Well, I think it was a combination of circumstances and luck, and the fact that the original story was so trustworthy and deeply reported. I mean, what I take from this is that it really underlines the value of journalism, both in the original reporting and then subsequently creating the breathing space for other women to come forward.
Yeah, it was interesting to me that the original series, as well told as it was, as good as the journalism was, didn't actually focus on Larry Nassar to begin with. Right. It focused on coaches and the accusations over the years of what they might have done, but it was the gymnast that she referred to, the prosecutor referred to, who came forward, Rachel Denhollander. She read the stories in the Indianapolis Star. She approached the Star and told them about Nassar, and then it went from there.
But I think the larger story here, which is something that really needs to be fleshed out by journalists and others, is that we focus on the individuals that were doing the harm. We focus on the Nassars when there's a culture of this kind of thing happening. And that was what the Orange County Register was exposing. But I think we can fall back into this idea of we have to have this one evil person. Yeah. Yeah. And when in fact, it could be a culture that creates these opportunities for these people to actually do what they're doing.
Yeah, there's the tendency to see this as a bad apple thing, when what in fact happened was that all the processes and guardrails that was meant to stop something like this from happening failed these young women.
So, I mean, not only at USA Gymnastics, but at Michigan State University, where this doctor worked, but we can say that after all these years of abuse at the end of this trial, well, Nassar's not only going to prison, but of course he was fired before that. People have stepped down from the board of USA Gymnastics. The president at Michigan State University, whatever you might think about all of the things that she did positively at that university, also stepped down. But it kind of seemed to me like all of those enablers were kind of arrogant all the way up to the trial.
And that's usually the case. I mean, you could say the same thing happened at Penn State. I mean, if you go back and look at those original stories that the Orange County Register did, you had people within USOC and who were complicit in it that continued to allow this to happen or did not put things in place to make sure that this didn't continue. And now we wind up where we are today.
And this story also falls in line with a lot of good work that journalists have done to just uncover sexual harassment and issues facing women this year. And we could tick off all the others, but it seems to me like journalists have not for once let go of the rope. They're trying to do more.
What I really liked about this story was the humility of the journalists. And they were saying, you know, we were just doing our jobs, right? And that the focus should be on the bravery of the women involved. I think that's commendable.
Yeah. Well, finally, let's talk some more about Facebook. It seems like we do every week, Facebook and journalism. You'll recall that the social media giant said a while back that it was changing its algorithm so that fewer published news stories would show up in your news feed unless they happened to be shared by a Facebook friend or you were following them already. Then Facebook said it was going to put an emphasis on news that was from trustworthy sources. Although it was kind of interesting, there was a lot of debate about what trustworthy meant or how it was going to be measured. Facebook put out a two-question survey to its users that was supposed to help with that. And now Mark Zuckerberg has announced just this week that Facebook is going to bring more local news stories to your feed, even if you didn't ask to see them. So how does all that work?
You know, this is sort of like we're going to do news this week, and then next week we're not going to do news, or we're going to do the national news or international news, and now we're going to do local. And then when you read about at least what Zuckerberg was saying and what they want to do, they're going to decide what is local. So that could be within a 50-mile radius or a 100-mile radius or 150-mile radius. So it's almost like, you know, exactly what are you going to do? And as a person who's using Facebook, do I get to decide or are you deciding? So there's a lot of confusion here as to where they're going with this.
There was a story that I read on Neiman that began with the lead, whiplash alert. Facebook will give local news sources a signal boost. And I think that about sums it up. I mean, on the one hand, it's good that, you know, we can commend them for trying to take some action here, but it does seem like they're throwing stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks.
It also is interesting and I think relevant to talk about Facebook's motivation. I mean, I don't see them as the big, you know, evil company out there that only thinks about profits. I mean, they are a business. They have a right to run their business the way they want. But it also seems like, as we've said many times on this show lately, there's another motivation, trying to basically stave off regulation.
And I think that's a huge thing because right now they're getting criticized from all quarters. And their biggest concern, I mean, whether you're talking about Facebook or Google or Twitter, is that there's going to be some coalition within some government structure, be it here in the United States or over in Europe or somewhere else, that's going to come in and say, you know what, you guys are too big to fail. And you have a lot of control, and we need to make sure that you aren't causing harm to the overall populace.
Yeah, well, there's the research that is coming out now is increasingly showing Facebook's link with polarization, misinformation. So on the one hand, it's commendable that they're doing something, but it is a bit like inviting the arsonist to put out the fire, right? I mean, local journalism has really suffered over the past decade. I saw one stat that said the workforce has shrunk by 40%. So, I mean, the damage to local news has already been done. Whether this will go some way to sort of repairing things, I'm not too sure.
I wonder if you'd also just say a little bit more about whether or not you think they can successfully stave off regulation. They haven't been successful in Europe. So far, they have in the U.S.
I think in the U.S., they're going to, I don't think they're going to have the problems that they had over in Europe because of just the way in which we are, the situation we're in right now where, you know, you have President Trump and you have his people at the FCC and at Treasury and at other areas who aren't into regulation. They're trying to do away with a lot of the regulations. So I think right now they're fine, but that doesn't mean that won't change with the next, you know, with the next president or the next Congress. I mean, you just never know.
I think Europe is more regulation friendly on most things than the United States. There's a context there.
I still wonder too whether or not it's possible for Facebook to successfully tamp down the kind of fringe journalism and fake news. I mean, it's difficult technically, especially with as much of it as is out there right now. So we'll see if any of these things that they're trying will actually work. That's going to have to do it, though, for another week for us. Thank you for listening and watching. Thanks to Ernest and Ryan for their analysis. You can read more about the topics we discussed today on our links blog. It's under the programs tab at kbia.org. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. If you're not a bot, our handle is @views on KBIA. These are great ways to listen to and watch the program over again. You can also leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's program and to KBIA's Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. Austin Howard and John Saltzman are our associate producers. I'm Mike McKean. Join Amy Simons, Ernest Perry, and me again next week for another edition of Views of the News.